listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Is it ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
They are recording.
Okay.
Somehow we gender segregated ourselves.
Oh, no, I promise I'll be okay. That's interesting. Hey, guys. So welcome back. So hope everyone had a nice lunch. So we had like a nice, I think, discussion. It got maybe heated, maybe really deep, a type of discussion we had. So it was nice. So hopefully we'll be able to have that same kind of panel discussion following the three speakers that you'll be hearing from now. So next up will be Khalil. He's originally from Tunisia. Khalil is an artist and activist who left his home to enrich his artistic career by learning about different histories and cultural traditions. Khalil grew up in a Muslim community before immigrating to New York as an adult. Passionate about youth leadership and human rights, Khalil has also witnessed firsthand the effects of extremism amongst adolescents and young adults. He strives for both equality and equity through working with different organizations such as Search for Common Ground, Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and We Love Kairun. Also, Khalil works in the New York area to develop and maintain Mala's community networks and create opportunities for community engagement. And it's been great. I met Khalil since he first came here, I think, so I've known him for a while now. And it's also great his work with Mala helps Muslimish because we partner together for different things. And so we have certain events. If you've ever been to WeWork, those events are done because of Khalil's efforts to allow us to host them there. So now I'll leave the floor for him, and he'll be describing a personal story.
Wow. Okay. So thank you for being here. And I'm really honored to speak today about my humble story. I mean, I'm only 24 years old, so I don't know if you guys are going to hear a lot in my lifetime because I'm still young, and that's good for me. I'm going to start with two things. The first thing is small paragraph, and then we're going to watch a video. It's like 2 minutes video. It's good for a nap after the lunch we had. And it's about my city and where I came from. So you guys, you will see the colors, the people there, the city, the mosques. I will start with the first thing that you need to know about ex-Muslim is that the best term in Arabic to describe us is basically a swear word, murtad, meaning someone who turns their back on Islam. The word has a dirty, spit on the ground feeling to it, with a rolling R and a sharp drop of at the end. And moving from that, I'll show you my city, and I hope you like it.
Thank you.
guess. So I was born and raised in Qayrawan, which is the fourth Islamic capital in the world. Also, I grew up in a very conservative community and very gated family. My two uncles were imams. And growing up, I just, you know, figured that I could be an artist. And I started, like, drawing. And I had that first comment of, stop doing that. It's forbidden. And we were discussing earlier about this thing. And I can't give it a soul. I'm just, like, drawing faces and drawing pictures and adding colors. And they were, like, trying to stop me since I was a kid. Also, I have to mention this, which is I'm lifty. And I can't eat my lunch because I'm using the left hand. So my hand is going to be, like, tied up, and I should use the right one. Because if I use the left one, the evil is going to eat with me. Yeah. So, when I was 15, the revolution came to Tunisia, started in Tunisia, and a lot of eyes opened, and a lot of opportunities to youth became more easy to get, and I was one of them. I was only 15 years old, and I started meeting people from different backgrounds, especially Muslims. That I've never heard about, which they're Salafist and Dawah and different groups in the left part. They were like communists and free thinkers. And I started like learning about them and reading books and reading articles and discussing different topics about human rights and religion, and from that I started building kind of a personality of asking a lot of questions to first my family. And I remember when I just, you know, even if I have like a question about Isra wal Mi'raj, which is doesn't make sense for me with as a kid. It was very creative the way how the story they told out the story, and it was only one answer, which is tilka hudud Allah fala taqrabuha, which is we have red lines you can't cross, we have limits you can't cross, you can't even think about those things because God created us and God made this Quran and everything is perfect and we can't question anything. So I get upset because I couldn't find a good answers. So I went from my like close community, which is my family, to making friends. And the first or the only place that I found that respected me was a youth for not communists, but they're more socialists. And they actually recruited me as a free thinker. And they started like giving me books and helped me figure out some stuff that I can't find answers to. So I became like I guess activist is a big word and I can't say it, but I guess I became more active on the community and asking everyone on the like cafe and like in school I started like into politics, and it was like our fashion that in those years because of the revolution everyone is doing politics and everyone has an opinion, everyone has commands and ideas, and I got into a lot of troubles because of that. So asking about religion and doing politics with the left part makes me, they actually kicked me out from community, and I was like the kafir shuyoi, which is the kafir communist, which is like, I mean, two great names that there were a reason to, I got kicked from school. They destroyed my art. They actually even bit me, and it was very hard to escape, you know, the amount of hatred and problems there. So I got into like that void of leaving religion, but not finding any thing to refill that place, because religion was a place to pray and say whatever you have in your heart to God, so He can hear you. And it was like a meditation, and then you just left the religion, and you don't have nothing to do, or no one to say your problems to, because everyone was like worried about even sitting with me. Even like my close friends, they abandoned me because I am a free thinker, not an atheist. So I went like between 2011 to 2014 was like 3 years of progress, getting into a lot of details and learning more about movements in the world. And the end of 2014, like June 20th, I actually found a replacement for the religion, which is love. I met my wife, and I thought that is going to be, you know, very helpful, that love is going to give me solutions and makes me closer to the community. But it was totally the opposite, because even my wife, she's a soldier. she's a feminist, and she's a human rights activist. And but I guess I found someone on my team. I mean, next to me, fighting with me, and we started a new journey from there that almost got us killed. But it was fun. It was fun. I loved it because I wasn't alone. Until now. So between 2014 and 2016, we had a huge experience with youth that they were going and recruited by ISIS, and they were going to from Tunisia, Libya to Turkey, and they go to Syria. And so Tunisia, they send like over 8,000 soldier jihadists to Syria, and 60% of those people, they were from my city. Even a lot of terrorist groups, they were created by the name of Aqba, which is from my city. And the first mosque that he built in the history was that great mosque that you saw in the video. And so Asma, she was like doing this project with youth from small neighborhoods that they were into drugs or terrorism. Or not terrorism, let's say, like extremism. And she was trying to recruit them to do art, like theater, through psychodrama, which is a therapy through theater. And I got very interested, and we started a journey together. They kicked us out from every cultural space. They didn't give us any spaces to rehearse. So we rehearsed on the place where the first Salafist meeting was held in Qayrawan, and we got a lot of trouble because of that. They attacked us in our home because we were living together and we're not married, and that's not legal and forbidden. But we were crazy back then. And we were enjoying it. We were enjoying disturbing those groups and telling them that, hey, we're here and we're growing up and we'll change, we'll keep an impact. But when it comes to our lives, my family, Asma, they were like, let's get the hell out of here. And I was like, no, I'm not leaving. And we got into a fight. And she was like, let's travel, find another place, build a career. And when we have money, power, and we're like, we can go back and take a place on the country, and we can change and we can do real change. And I was like, no, I'm not leaving my city. I'm not leaving my friends. I'm not leaving, because they're living in a place that could take them in wrong paths, and let me help them. And she was like, okay, go with me to the embassy, take your visa, and then decide. A week before, we get a group attacked me, and then when I had my visa, after like 2 days, I have all my papers ready to go to America. I was very scared, and not because just of me. I mean, because I have my girlfriend back there. She's with me, and I don't want her to get hurt. So we just kept everything there. I left my family, my little room with all my arts and thoughts, just to start a new life, to learn more about the world, and to find a way to change things back there. So we arrived here to the US at November 8th. It was a great night. I'm so lucky. It was the election night, 2016. We watched the results at the 42nd Street. We were like huge TVs. And they was so happy because Trump is not getting a lot of votes. And someone next to me, he said, like, but he's still winning. I was like, how? I mean, I didn't know that. I mean, there are like different rules here. I mean, but anyway, it was a great night. It was a memorable night. And we actually started our, you know, path, new path from there, from restaurants to workshops to meeting beautiful people, that helped us a lot to find our way, and to find good jobs. And now I'm really happy that I took the risk to come to the US and to share this humble story with you. And I'm really happy that I have a good job now, and I work for the Muslim community, but more safe. I can say my opinions. I can discuss with them without any risks. And I'm really happy to work for the community, for the Muslim American community, to learn more about the community here and to get their stories and to put the community together into events, artistic, cultural events, to be part of Muslimish, as I mean, to listen to more debates, to listen to more thoughts. And today I'm really proud also. My wife, we got married last November, and she's a Broadway actress now, and she's doing well. But just the only thing that I'm going to add, and I guess I'm done. It was it's kind of a joke. So I was getting threats back home from Muslims, extremists, and I ran away to the U.S. After the New Zealand accident, the problem, the mosque back in New Zealand, we actually had the threat on our organization's Facebook page. It was a comment from a guy who's from Texas, said that he's going to kill us. So I told the story to my wife, and she was like, really? I mean, you're not going to get killed by Muslims, but you're going to get killed by atheists. And I was like, oh, no worries. We're in the US. So Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for having me here. And I guess that's it.
Oh, no, just in here. Take questions, I guess.
Questions?
Yeah. Do you not want to take questions?
I love taking questions. Okay. I don't know how to answer. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. It's okay, you can just go.
Sure.
She used the mic so people
other record. Why were you
please use the mic so people the recording?
No.
Oh, sorry.
I thought you didn't want to take the mic.
Why were you attacked and who attacked you? Or beat you?
They were Ansar Sharia, which is Sharia supporters, and different other groups that they were made after the revolution in Tunisia. They attacked me and actually us because we were recruiting people from their groups to go into more artistic way and just, you know, taking those extremism and terrorism thoughts from their minds. Is that fine? Yeah, I've never did this.
First time talking.
Kind of interesting listening to you because, like, I come from a really conservative family, but, like, yeah, I'm like 20, so it's kind of like really interesting. It's like this whole organization and everything. I wanted to ask you a question. Now that you're working for the Muslim American community, do you meet with imams or sheikhs or religious scholars and like host programs with them or any type like dialogue with them for like Muslim youth? Like,
yeah, it was a Well, I met with a couple of them. One was from the Caucasus. It was from Azerbaijan. And another one, it was American converted. And to be honest, they're not the same as our imams. They're very, and yeah, I mean, they understand what I'm saying and they agree that those groups are bad and they're using Quran as it is. I don't know how they should use it, but I mean, yeah, I met with them and still have the same thoughts because I think they're very they're using diplomacy with their religion. But yeah, but I love talking to them, by the way. Makes me feel happy. Yeah, first.
So we were talking outside at the table about spirituality and art.
Backstage, yeah.
Yeah, backstage. And you mentioned Sa'ul Ma'raj.
Yes.
And the fact that you were not allowed to question it. And the fact that later your art was destroyed. For me, Sa'ul Ma'raj is one of, you know, it's a beautiful story in the Islamic heritage, Islamic tradition. And the fact that it's reduced to, you know, some little, you know, anti-gods here and there is really does not give it justice. And I believe it's a huge part of humanity's heritage because the path it led later to even the Renaissance is, you know, not really recognized. And for me, the fact that you stopped to question it, killed that, you know, attack, you know, killed, not for you, but, you know, it's people coming from that heritage, a total, a path in spirituality that's very enriching. But also the same people also destroy their art. I just want to, you know, hear your thoughts about spirituality, art, you know, from growing up.
So the question?
I don't know what's the Yeah, you're
okay. You're, so yes, talking about. All right, I'll put it this way: the Isra and Mi'raj, as a story, It's beautiful. And I'd love to illustrate it and make it as a book, but I would go to jail or get killed. Because you can't draw that. So this is one between the relation, I mean, art and religion. But in the meantime, I'm a calligrapher. And I use, I mean, Arabic letter, which there came from Quran. So there is a relation between art and religion, because religion is a part of the culture, right? But going to spirituality, I've been there. And as I said, I was like, I mean, from Sunnah, I read about Mu'tazila. I was surprised that they're like a group using their minds. And they put in like reasons and cause and there is a result. And they asked a question, what happened if they don't have a result? They were using the same methods as going to Imam or going back to the Nas, which is the script. And then I went to the like Sufism. I love being present in a group of Sufism, like, you know, listen to music and that beautiful smell of atar and oud, and I love that. But as I said before, like, we're backstage, it's a kind of a painkiller for me. That's it. It's like a painkiller. I mean, I need answers. I need something that I can touch. And from there, like, moving from there is like going to dialectics and more materialistic things. But yes, so is that fine for your conclusion, or because it wasn't a question? So.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
One more question?
Well, it was last minute things.
I just want to relate a story that occurred in the 70s. I had formed a group with some other friends called Pakistan Progressive, and we used to publish a newsletter, Pakistan Progressive itself, and the purpose was demonstration. We would have dictators come and give demonstrate and so on. And then we learned that there was a fundamentalist group of Muslims in Brooklyn who were having their big gathering. So being a naive liberals, we thought we could go and have a dialogue with them. And we did, and we got roughed up, badly.
70s, and in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. The lesson we drew from that is that you can't reason with fundamentalists. And the second lesson we draw was when people resort to violence or name-calling, it means they have lost an argument. They are no longer able to answer to your position. So that's the lesson I
can share
with you. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, going back to your art, so now you are in America. What inspiration do you find for your artistic pursuit now? And also, if you have find the art as a way of inspiring the new young Muslim leaders in America?
My wife, she's saying, like, me, I'm the inspiration. She's like, no, I live in New York. So I guess that's enough answer for inspiration part. It's everything actually inspired me. People, different communities, culture, backgrounds. I remember this first interview that I did in English. It was like the first week. When I came to New York, it was in the Arab Radio, New York City. He asked me, like, you do calligraphy, why you're here? I mean, I was like, even those tags that you can find at the train, the subways, like with pens, those are letters. Those are like, there is a message through those lines and how aggressive the lines are, or how hard they're, like, you know, chill So there are like a lot of places where I can find an inspiration here in New York, especially people or human being. What was the other part?
The second part was, did you have you find that art is a positive message and integrating the Muslim American leadership, the youth group
yes.
involved with, are you integrating art in those?
So, for example, since I started working for MALA, which is the Muslim American Leadership Alliance, my art actually helped me first to know more people. Because everyone is like, who was looking for that calligrapher that works for MALA and wants to know more how they write beautifully or how they can do that art, especially I make it easy. I'm always saying that if you know how to write your name, that's enough to do calligraphy. You need just to practice. And I guess, I don't know the answer exactly if I'm inspiring those Muslim American leaders, because I'm not that well known yet, or I didn't ask that question. But I guess I'm doing my best to share my art. I've been doing workshops here in New York, DC, Chicago. So I'm trying, and I guess, yeah, that's it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, so I don't need this, I guess. Where's my Sam? Oh, he's like looking for you. So that was a great talk. It was great. I think in the morning we were talking about facts and stuff. And so it's interesting, we saw a different set of facts here. He was presenting facts in his own life and having a personal story. So hopefully that was a contrast to some of the morning talks we had. And now we'll have Wissam speaking. He's gracious enough to set up the slides, which I should be doing. But Wissam, he's right here, is an engineer, entrepreneur, educator, activist who identifies himself as a humanist Arab. He was born in United Arab Emirates to Lebanese parents. His family immigrated to the U.S. and he became an American citizen in 2004. He received a bachelor's in electrical and computer engineering from Wayne State University in Detroit and a master's in software engineering from University of Michigan, while also studying Islamic studies through distant programs and local scholars. And he was an ardent Islamic activist, founder of Muslim Scouts of Michigan, Halakhan Imam al-Baqir, and Institute for Religious Studies, Humanities and Dialogue, Irshad, which became more of an Islamic reform organization, which I think Wissam is still part of. And Wissam was also a member of Amnesty International and the vice chairman of the Islamic House of Wisdom. In 2006, while researching to write an article about Islam and evolution, he found a new understanding of science through that research and adapted a new understanding of life based on it. He co-founded Muslimish in 2012 in order to create an environment for support and dialogue in questioning Islam and fight for freedom of expression and against blasphemy laws in Islamic countries. So I think Sam's still setting up. He also, oh, great. That's perfect timing.
We're done?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Zira. And thank you for all the organizers that have put this together. And thanks for everyone, of course, who's showing up and always in support of Muslimish. Today's presentation is really, it's really about Islamic reform. And the reason I'm going to speak about Islamic reform is because religion is not going anywhere anytime soon. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about why do we have to ally ourselves with reform Islam, because it is the natural progression of Islam into the progress of civilization. The question that comes when we talk about religion in general, do we reform or abolish? if you look at the movements in history of the attempts of abolishing religions in history, whether it is the de-Christianization of France after the French Revolution, or you know what the attempts of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, or any example in history where there were attempts of abolishing a religion, the trials of certain power houses that tried to, for example, eliminate some sects in Islam, the pressure to eliminate Shiism that resulted in some cases of creating a more extreme groups like Alawites and others. It has never been successful. These attempts have never been successful to do so by force. And we're not discussing whether it is right or wrong to abolish a religion that you don't agree with. It's just not something that historically has been successful. Reform is progressive. It's natural. It's easier and it is less violent. It actually is a natural sociological phenomenon. The problem is that religion sometimes is resistant to reform. So in that case, reform is really a form of really breaking away from religion. It's breaking some parts of religion that are rigid and are uneasy towards change. Someone mentioned earlier, I forgot whose presentation, that sometimes reformists are called atheists. They are accused as being non-religious or against religion, Ibrahim. So they are actually put at the same boat as Muslims who have, for example, left Islam or criticize Islam. Even reformists who are religious, who are scholars, who are pious, who have spent their life studying Islam and promoting Islam, they are put in the same boat as such, and they sometimes receive the same punishment, if not worse. And that's throughout history, by the way. It's not a new thing. Sociology recommends for us reform versus abolishment. Religion and culture intermix. That's another complication that we have to understand, is that religion and culture intermix in a way that becomes impossible to separate between them. I think Muslimish is a unique organization that accepts that fact, and that's why it kept Islam within its name. So if a person, Muslimish has a variety of people with different degrees of religiosity, but even if a person is not a Muslim, but yet identifies culturally with Islam, they identify with Muslimish because of that color of cultural identity within religion. And hence, reform is more culture-friendly. One of the things that we hear the most when we speak about people who are questioning is just the fear of breaking away from that culture, the fear of isolation, and the comfort of being part of that culture. Now, if we separate between the two, if the culture is completely safe to identify as, while questioning, then you are opening a lot of space for free thinking. Previous trials of about, we've talked about this, people frequently need religion as an emotional outlet. I think Khalil beautifully expressed that. So religion can play a positive role in so many aspects and so many cultures. Reform is less prone to violence, and reform is better in preserving heritage and positive. So there are some positives within religion, because religion is not separable from the progress of civilizations. These thinkers, and whether they have, drawn some divinity towards the ideas that they are coming up with, or the theories that they're coming up with, they're giving it some holiness to it, or divinity to it. At the end of the day, it's man-made, and it is a part of a longer heritage. It doesn't come from a complete vacuum. So there are things that are worth preserving within the folds of different religions. And when you call for reform, you can preserve these heritage within it. And one of the things, for example, I was shocked when I went in my visit last year to Paris, in the process of the de-Christianization of the nation, that they have even removed all Christian symbols from all sculptures, and France is full of sculptures. Every cross has been broken at that period. It has been replaced by other symbols of enlightenment. And I felt that's a little bit harsh. That's almost destruction of art and heritage. I felt that. And it didn't work at the end of the day. I mean, and Napoleon understood that. And the last thing I want to say is that religion is natural and science is not. We have to understand that as we tread carefully. And that's why there is a big discrepancy between science and public perception of science. There's actually a book about this topic. The battle between religion and science, competing methods of knowing ourselves and our world, has been raging for many centuries. Now, scientists themselves are looking at cognitive foundations of religion and arriving at some surprising conclusions. This book, drawing on the latest research and illustrating the argument with common sense examples, it argues that religion has existed for many thousands of years in every society because the kinds of explanations it provides are precisely the kinds that come naturally to human minds. Science, on the other hand, is a much more recent and rare development because it reaches radical conclusions and requires a kind of abstract thinking that only arises consistently under very specific social conditions. Religion makes intuitive sense to us, while science requires a lot of work. When I sit with my parents, for example, and when I was, because I have a background in Islamic studies before, and when they used to have Islamic like questions that they wanted my religious opinion about, so I would give them my religious opinion and explain things from a religious perspective. And now I find it much harder with my new understanding to explain things because they need a lot of background information, a lot of understanding of science. Meaning that we have evolved for survival and not really for abstract understanding. That's like a misfiring of our evolution. When a child sees the sun moving in the sky, that's the reference point is Earth, and they see it moving. It took humanity a while to recognize that the Earth is actually moving. It's a very simple question. What would it look like if they asked themselves long time ago, what would it look like if Earth is moving? And the answer would be, it would look exactly the same. So it's possible that the Earth is moving. But one simple question, what Einstein used to call mind experiments. You know, sometimes you don't need a lab, just a question in your mind. You can come with like results. So a simple question that would have enlightened humanity that it is as possible that the Earth is moving. Nobody asked that question, and some people were burned at the stake for asking it later. So, I mean, because it defies our simple nature, you know, simple nature, our eyes that has evolved to see as far as we need to run from a lion. And, you know, the one thing that is amazing is the percentage of people who start having a weakness in sight after the age of 40 is almost 100%, meaning after the age of really full reproduction, the DNA really doesn't really care a lot about, and I'm sorry about using these terms as an engineer. I know scientists are going crazy here. But so today I'm going to discuss the root, because this is the title of the conference and I wanted to serve to that. If you see, because there's so many different issues, contemporary issues, some problems that we can see in Islam. But if we try to, this is my effort to find the roots. Like if you see why are these happening and come to root problems. So I want to present six root problems and their solutions. It's very important that I'm going to also mention the solutions, which is really presented, real solutions by reform Islam. Now, that's not something necessarily that I adopt. I'm just speaking from Islamic academic point of view. And I am, as Zirar has said, a member of an organization that works in that effort. And this effort, by the way, has a momentum today in the Islamic world and also has a big resistance. Most reform scholars are under prosecution in many countries, especially today in Saudi Arabia. Most reform scholars, speaking to the question of Saudi Arabia wanting actually reform or not, most reform scholars are actually in prison today in Saudi Arabia, and some of them have the death penalty for treason, like Sheikh Malik Farhan al-Maliki. So so this is six root problems. I'm not going to dwell a lot on them. First of all, is the problem of duality, that there is two voices that create contradictions within the text itself. And I'm going to talk about Quran. Forget about Hadith for a minute. So there's two voices, duality. So sometimes this duality is explained through the Madani versus the Mecca Quran. It's very, very obvious for any one of us who read Quran. There is Mecca, there's Quran that was revealed in Mecca. Islam was 23 years was the age of Islam during the life of the Prophet. Like from the first revelation till the death of the Prophet, it's 23 years. 13 were in Mecca. And 11, 10 and a half were in Medina. There were Quran that was revealed in Mecca, Quran was revealed in Medina. And actually the top of the surah defines, it says like Mecca, this is a Mecca Quran, this is a Medina Quran. And they have different tones, totally different tones. Of course, there was no jurisprudence before Mecca. Mecca Islam was a spiritual Islam. The verses were poetic. They were mostly the hereafter. They were short, they were abstract, and they did not deal with any laws or any things like this. Even attitudes with different people was different. Like the attitude with Christians and Jews was very friendly in the Mecca Quran. The Medina Quran were the laws, the state, long verses, very complicated verses, all the political verses, many of the political verses, they're all in Medina. So that's one. So Muslims might say, you know, there was a different stage, it needed a different voice. But the problem is you have some contradictions sometimes. So they solve these contradictions by different theories. One is abrogation, that the newer, nasikh wal mansukh, the newer abrogates the older. Well, that's a problem because, for example, that's what Salafi jihadists adopt. And they say all the war verses, they have abrogated all the peace verses, because all the peaceful verses are earlier, and all the war verses, like Surah At-Tawbah, chapter 11, right? Part 11, chapter 9. It was later. So these verses were very militant. They were very violent, and they say it abrogated everything before it. So this is the last Islam. This is the version of Islam that we adopt. Some say no. When verses contradict, there is ta'mim wa takhsis. There is generalization and there is privatization. So this verse is private and this verse is general. And the general rules the private. And some say it's about circumstantial and eternal. This verse is for these specific circumstances, while this verse is eternal. La ikraha fi al-deen. There is no compulsion in religion. For example, they say it is general. While another verse which says that if you find a non-Muslim, you know, within 4 months from today, then you are to slaughter them. This is circumstantial. It is only for those circumstances. So this is different interpretations that Islam has said. Nevertheless, whatever it is, it creates issues dealing with the text. There's also a change of direction. There is a change of direction. It's like a country changing its foreign policy. That's also something in the Quran. The position with the Jews was very, very friendly. And the Quran in the beginning was referring the Quraysh society to the Jews as witnesses on the truth of Islam. And then when the political clash with the Jews of Yathrib, the Jews of Medina happened, the Quran changed and became a little bit aggressive or hostile to Judaism. So this change of directions also creates some sort of contradictions. Not dwelling more on the issue of contradictions, here's some solutions that Reform Islam presents. And this is something that is really critical. So you have to be selective. That is the key word. The taboo of selectivity has to be removed. If Islam is going to move anywhere, there's no other solution. If I have to end this talk right now, I would end it at this point. Is that Islam, Muslims, in order for them to move forward, they have to accept being selective, something that Christians have accepted and created in New Testaments. And I'm not saying that they have found the right solution, but they were more flexible about it. Muslims yet are stuck to the text letter by letter, word by word. And I'm not saying that to throw the text away. It's just saying being selective, saying that there are the Quran is contextual. It was revealed at a certain time that was befitting the circumstances of that time. But if we select these verses that are relevant to us, that create a general trend of morality and spirituality, then this we can work with this Quran that's more relevant to us. And there is an Islamic way of explaining this. So if a reform movement is not really dealing with that, all the reinterpretation and what wadribuhun means to turn your face away and all the apologetics, that doesn't work. That never worked. It actually emboldens fundamentalism. Fundamentals, they laugh at this new versions of Amr Khalid Islam and diluted Islam that is contradictory. Like the Quran has a voice. You have a text. This is a very strong source. They only have to use. The most people that quote Quran are the fundamentalists because it is their tone of voice. They don't need to go anywhere far to get their inspiration. If we don't say that, no, this is not going to work anymore. We need a shorter. That's something that Irshad has been working on, actually, one of the reform organizations, and actually has put a book into publication called Min al-Quran, From the Quran, hoping that this becomes like a selection of the verses that are more relevant to us, and things that are no longer relevant to us, we move away from them. Shows the spirit of the Quran. There is more efforts in that path. The problem of sources. A big problem in Islam. Yani this Dutch Orientalist says in our special times, there's very little that is above criticism. And one day or other, we may expect to hear even that Muhammad never existed. Yani there is so much lack of sources. I'm not saying that that's correct. I'm just saying that there's so much lack of sources that academically, there is nothing that is above criticism with the sources that we have. The level of bias, the allegiances, there's nothing that we have that is objective or academic in the least sense. Some people argue there's nothing objective in life, but I mean, even has a source of objectivity, scientific objectivity to it, or historical objectivity. Everything was written under the supervision of the sultan, of the rulers. There were books that were burnt early on, like the first book written about the history of the Prophet by the son of Uthman ibn Affan, before even paper was, he used to use 3 donkeys to carry it, because it's all like wood and leather and stuff. It was burnt by Hisham ibn al-Hakam. Thank you. Tribalism, politics, interpretations, all these things that have caused problems of resources. The solution is use the general guidelines and values and flexibility of the fatwa to grow less dependent on existing sources and more dependent on the spirit perceived of Islam. So you have values that you have understood from Islam, then use it more for ijtihad, for really making out your new religion, coming up with solutions for your religion instead of depending on the text. So grow less dependent on the text and find ways to more ways of fiqh. I'm not going to go into details. This is can serve for more than one purpose, and I'm thinking about the recording afterwards. So this can serve as an invitation for reform for many of the Muslims, or a proposal for reform. And for the non-Muslims or ex-Muslims, this can be just an understanding of the effort of reform, because we need to be allied with these people. We need to be on the same page as these people in terms of, because they are going to cut off or trim all the parts that are really harmful about having Islam in society today, to tell you the truth. Problem with methodologies, we don't follow like the scientific method in Islam. So there's no defined methodology. There's different methodologies adopted by different schools of thought that were chosen by politics long time ago. So also, one way to solve this problem is to academize Islamic studies. It's something that Christianity has gone through, and they have trimmed the religion into more of a relationship, more of a spiritual thing, and we see a lot less harm from it coming. I'm not belittling of any effects of also Christianity on even the lightest form of it. But some these things have been done before in different religions, Reform Judaism, etc. Unify Islamic studies standards away from sectarianism. So Al-Azhar University has done some reform early on. If it wasn't for that, we would have a million madrasas in the Islamic world instead of 100,000 madrasas. And also, there was an effort by Shia Islam, for example, Sheikh Muhammad Rida al-Muzaffar, who was, you know, also accused of secularism because of that effort of only creating an academic. Yeah, he created the Kuliyat al-Imam al-Sadiq, al-Fiqh. He created a college that is, a part of a university for Islamic studies, and doing that, defying the religious method of Hawza within Shia Islam, he got a lot of a criticism for that. So we need to also, that is something that is good for the secular movement, is the academic, you know, creating an academic standards for Islamic studies. We're finding more often now in Islamic centers and conferences, academics, like Muslim academics from universities, from Oxford, and speaking about Islam, which is a positive thing, because they have more academic training on the subject. The problem of religious authority, there's multiple authorities with not one single authority that can have a final say or a control or a direction of the Islamic world. And there is no effort, of course, this is very political, there is no effort to unify this. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation is the new name for the Jama'a Dual Islamiyah. Has no effort really in creating an Islamic authority. Some sort of a congress of all muftis or even mimic the Catholic organizational architecture. There's no effort to that. There was very humble efforts. For example, there is a very progressive marja, like an Islamic authority, an ayatollah from Lebanon. His name is Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, considered a progressive, the most progressive Shia scholar. He created a theory which is called the institutional marja'iyah. Like, instead of having a man as a mufti, have an institution with membership, with departments, with colleges, with committees connected to universities that can come up with studies and make a fatwa. Of course, didn't go anywhere, but I mean, the theory is there. Sayyid Jamal Din al-Afghani, he had a theory previously, and he had connections with the Sultan at that time, Abdul Hamid, during the Ottoman time. By the way, Sayyid Jamal Din al-Afghani, very interesting personality, is accused actually of being an atheist. He had a lot of secular thought, but he maintained his Islamic position, and he toured the Islamic world trying to find solutions to modernize the Islamic world. I think there will be a renaissance where these thoughts will come back as reform Islam grows. The problem of cultural variability, rules follow custom. So cultures, right? The Islam of Bangladesh is different from the Islam of Morocco. The culture presents totally different Islam. They almost have to introduce each other to a new religion, but they still they have common expressions. So culture has a big, and Islam has allowed culture to influence it. To actually allow that more, like this problem is a good problem, is to allow culture to take over some aspects. For example, there is nothing, as you know, Islamic reformists, they say, is nothing in the Quran that talks about hijab, like the wujub of hijab. And I'm not going to talk about this, but you can refer to all this literature online about it. So it is something that is, Islam talks about, in the Quran, the only thing that is mentioned is al-hushma, yani the, in terms of modesty in clothing. So the modesty in clothing used to be interpreted as hijab. Previously, some scholars today, they say that you can move away from that older interpretation of modesty into newer interpretation of what does modesty mean, not necessarily covering the head. So the more you allow culture to determine the interpretation of these general guidelines, the more Islam will be flexible to live on and to maneuver. Celebrate and respect culture. And problem of emotional validity. So this is one issue in Islam, is that it's not like a book that is providing you with an intellectual ideology. It is mixed, every letter and every word is mixed with feelings and emotions. You cannot separate them together. That's just the nature. Well, that has to do also with Arabic language, but that's the nature specifically of Quran. It is very emotional. A verse would be speaking about an idea, and then all of a sudden there is anger, and then there is sadness, and then there is لقد قالوا اتخذ الرحمن ولدا لقد جئتم شيئا إدا تكاد السماوات يتفطرن منه وتنهد الأرض. Why are you angry? You are presenting an idea. Why all this anger that you're trying to almost shake the person who is reading it? So it is an emotional, dramatic book, and every Friday sermon, and Muslims know here that it is a dramatic, you know, sermon. It's not like an intellectual sermon. It has a lot of emotions in it. I'm not saying it's necessarily a negative thing, but what I'm saying is that you cannot work your mind when there is feelings. It's like if I'm talking with someone about an intellectual subject and he gets worked out emotionally, I have to delay this discussion. Because, you know, you're right now you're worked out emotionally and you're not going to be thinking right. So that's an issue that Islam has to maneuver. And they can maneuver that through actually separating the rhetoric. It is really an abuse of people to bring this emotionality. I've had so many discussions with so many relatives, especially older ones. There is fear. There is this emotionality that right away jumps when there is an idea that is contradicting something that they have grown on to believe. There's so much emotions. One person, he told me, can we stop the discussion because I'm getting convinced. And I really want to see my dad after I die. You know, so can we stop it? Because I know that, where is this going? But I prefer to see my dad after I die. So this is very difficult to maneuver these minefields, and religion plays into that. I mean, especially those of you who are from Shia background, they know that emotions is like 99% of Shiism. You go look it up on YouTube. So separate the rhetoric, spiritual, emotional Islam from jurisprudence and intellectuality. When a scholar speaks on the Friday sermon, he has to remove. Imagine a professor talking and with all his emotions in an academic subject or presenting a subject to his class with so much emotions. I mean, students are going to be afraid to ask questions. You know, it's just you cannot understand or question when there's so much emotions involved. This has to be, for Reform Islam to get over this, is to separate between the two and remove taboos. Remove taboos. One word that was said by one of the scholars in the Reform organization I work with, they clipped it and it went viral. Within 3 months, over 10 million views. And we don't know on WhatsApp, because that's the social media of the Middle East, how many people saw it. There was a fatwa for his kufr, you know, for that he's an infidel. And what he said was, the subject of the lecture was Islam and art. And he was talking about the destruction of all the idols and the washing of all the paintings of the Kaaba when Mecca was conquered by the Prophet. And the scholar was discussing it, and he said, I don't necessarily exonerate the Prophet from doing that. So what he's saying is he might be wrong in doing that from a leadership perspective. He's not like saying Quran and he's wrong. It's just, you know, like this is a leadership. He saw that it is better to destroy all the signs of paganism. So he said, I don't exonerate him. So this clip was, and the title was, Sheikh Fulan does not exonerate the Prophet, you know. And go see the comments on YouTube, which we don't delete any of them, you know. Like, go see the artistic creativity and cursing. So Islamic reform. So some people tell me, like, do you get death threats in Muslimish? So I never yet got a death threat in Muslimish, but I used to get it when I was Muslim. Like, as a Muslim reformist, I used to get a very strong backlash more than now. This is it. I know there are no need for violence. I'm glad that I'm done with the 6 points. This is 6 points. This is the proposed solutions. And in order for Islam to, I've been working with this for a very long time, in order for Islam to move on, reform, very bold and courageous reform needs to be done. It might be done from the West because we are enjoying the freedom of expression. And the secular movement, they have to understand that they are allied naturally with the reform movements of religion. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Hussein. That was very interesting. I was just curious if there were, I mean, we're a little over time, but I'm curious how many questions there were. Are there a lot of one? There's one. Maybe we'll take one just to see.
We can leave it to the panel.
Panel, yeah. Okay. I took some pictures of his slides. So we'll go to the last talk now, and then we'll have the panel discussion. Ali Adib Al-Naimi is going to be speaking. He is, actually realized, do you have slides?
Yes.
You want to put them on while I just read about you? Yeah, there's another one over there. He's an Iraqi journalist, worked in Baghdad with BBC and PBS in 2003 after the American invasion, worked at the New York Times to cover several stories and supervise the work of the newsroom and the Iraqi reporters from 2004 to 2007. He then left to the U.S. in 2007 to take part in the Knight Wallace Journalism Fellowship in Michigan, and then moved to New York and finished his master's in journalism at NYU in 2010. He works now as a writer with Recife22.com, I think that's a website, and full-time lecturer in language and media at the Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at NYU. And so he's just kind of still setting up a bit. I guess I can entertain. I'll dance or something. The conspiracy theories.
Someone is conspiring against me.
The conspiracy theories. Anyone's ever seen Flat Earth video? The internet's, YouTube is a very interesting thing. When you start seeing videos of these other theories, they're very convincing. I've seen some Flat Earth ones, and you have to start looking it up because you're like, wait, what? Is that true? And it's... It's very interesting if you can really make a convincing argument, even if it's based on like nothing reasonable. So the other thing I don't know if was mentioned was Sam. If you're not familiar with them, he was also a founding member of Muslimish. And I'm trying to think of other stories.
You can sing.
Yeah, I can sing. Bye, bye, bye. I don't know the rest of the words. I guess topical things from Sam's talk. Yeah, it was interesting. There are many different points you brought up. Some of the things that are interesting are like where the text is from. It can be confusing too in the Quran because, I don't know, maybe Sam can address this too, that some surahs are like Makkah or Medina, but then within them, some of the ayahs are randomly taken like from Makkah or Medina. And so sometimes it's not clear. Like, so sometimes within the surah itself, it's not clear. Some of the surahs might be from another place. And even that, no one really knows sometimes. And so there's a lot of, like you were saying, there's a lot of ambiguity. And yeah, I mean, that's the one thing I found when I started delving into it, was the degree of ambiguity, the degree of interpretations that varied. And it was just like, oh, I guess it makes sense then to me, just to topic we're talking about, why stuff can get fundamentalist. Actually, when you read the Quran, it's not rigid at all in a way. It just says things one way, then it says other things. It's a very poetic. As Sam was saying, it's different than a scientific. Like when I write papers, there's a specific structure. There's an intro, the methods, and everything has a particular structure. The Quran is sort of flowing with whatever's happening at the time. It's very curious that it's not rigid at all, but you can take whatever you want. Some of the ayahs are rigid, some of them aren't. And like what Sam was saying, the Meccan ones are less so. Yeah.
What you probably want to do, doctor, is put it on the desktop.
It's not opening at all. It's not, just not opening.
Well, actually,
do you want to close this?
Uh-huh.
Where?
Oh, yeah, just
as a mess. Is this it? What happened? Does someone know? I don't know Windows very well. I don't know Windows.
Sorry,
what happened?
I
just don't know how to use Windows.
I guess not. Playing with battery. I just
don't know.
It's full loss.
I didn't want to get this.
Conspiracy.
Oh, you got it? Okay.
Inshallah.
Yeah, just copy it to the desktop. No, that's. Oh, I see. You weren't joking about conspiracy theory.
No. So this is, this is the folder.
But copy it, don't, just drag it. Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So, we shall go. It's open. We'll do this.
F5. We just switch. Oh, it's.
Yeah, and then.
Do you need the presenter? Do you need presenter notes?
Oh, sorry.
Do you need presenter notes?
No,
this is fine.
Okay. No, that's fine. No. Okay. I think we're. Yeah, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. We're good. thank you very much for the invitation. Really happy to be here today for two reasons. It's my first time being here, and it's really great to have such a intellectual group of people to talk to. The other thing is I had a bad dream this morning that it was 5:30 p.m. and I was not here. So I was driving in the dream with a friend, and it was rainy, and I was like, oh my God, what am I going to say? It's 5:30. I should have been there by 3:30. And then I woke up, so you know the feeling. You know, these feelings that you get when you have an exam or something and you missed it. So that's the second reason why I'm happy to be here, because it was just a dream, thank God. Actually, I gave the similar talk about this a couple of weeks ago. but it was mainly about politics, conspiracy theory and politics. But as we know, politics and religion, actually they intertwine, they affect each other. And in the Arab slash, why I put Arab slash Muslim, because it, well, I'm going to refer to some of the political events also to as an example of the mentality of having one model to explain everything, whether it's political, historic, or religious. And we'll see the relationship to what Wissam has just said about Islamic reform and how is that impacted by actually subscribing to this school of thinking. The conspiracy theory as the main or the most used model to explain things in history, politics, and religion. Let me start first by saying that conspiracy theory is not a unique Muslim or Arab thing. It is an international phenomenon. A lot of societies here in the U.S., I've talked to a lot of people, intellectual people actually, in universities and you know, in meetings, and those people were smart, have academic degrees, and they subscribe to conspiracy theory in explaining events of history, politics, or, you know, using the term that you will refer to in this presentation, the undefined they. You know, they are doing this, they want that. So it is a phenomenon around the world. It's a school of thinking. People subscribe to it, yeah. But why is it more damaging to societies in the Middle East or in the Muslim world? Why it is not as damaging in the US, for instance, or in Europe, more than it is in the Middle East? Why is it more of an issue there than we have here? We'll go one step at a time and we'll see why. Now, if you go and look for a definition of the conspiracy theory, we'll have several definitions. You have a definition here in Britannica that talks about an attempt to explain harmful or tragic events as the result of the actions of a small, powerful group. Another one by Webster, the Webster Dictionary, it's which I tend to, you know, like it more, which is simply it's a theory that explains an event or set of circumstances as the result of a secret plot by usually powerful conspirators. Now, whether it's a small or big, whether it's a government or just influential people, it's this short definition is mostly what people think of when you talk about conspiracy. The other thing is, when we discuss, when we talk about conspiracy theory, we're not talking about something that is necessarily logical. We're talking about a belief. It's not an actual an ideology that you discuss. It's not Marxism. It's not an ideology. It is a belief. You believe first that things don't look the way they are. There is always a hidden cause or a hidden conspirator behind things, and then you start to address things. So it is a belief. That's why it is not it's not a 1+1 discussion when you talk to people who believe in conspiracy theories. You have to be aware that they believe in that first and then start presenting your logical arguments. Because unless you defeat them 100% by scientific or by logical evidence, the belief is always there. Okay. Now, where does that come from? Well, if you go to the biblical Quranic story of how we all started, it's a conspiracy by, let's say, allowed by God, a conspiracy by Satan to seduce Adam and Eve, to eat the apple, and then we're all here. We're supposed to be in heaven, but we're all here right now. So the root of conspiracy in the thinking of some societies goes back to this first beginning of life. It was a conspiracy by Satan to take out Adam and Eve out of out of heaven, and to defy God, to show God that I can defy your powers, and it happened. Now, throughout history, we have other conspiracies or other conspiracy theories that have been adopted to describe or to interpret historic events. I'm focusing more here because of the nature of our talk on Islam. Now, I'm going to talk about two main conspiracy theories, for one from the Sunni side and one from the Shi'i side. Now, I hope you can read the... This book talks about a famous figure, mostly considered as a fictitious figure by scholars, and but a lot of people still believe in this person. This person is called Ibn Saba. He was considered the reason or the cause or the instigator of the events that happened at the time of the third caliph, when there was a revolution and the rebels came into Medina and they killed the third caliph and they instated the fourth caliph, who's the cousin of the Prophet, Imam Ali. And because of the war that happened after that between the wife of the Prophet along with some of his companions against Imam Ali, the fourth caliph, some of the scholars, let's say historians, they could not actually justify the discrepancy between calling all the companions of the Prophet as people of justice, people of high morality, and the fact that they actually had a war and they killed each other. So they resorted to the idea of conspiracy theory by this man who's called Ibn Saba. This guy was from Yemen. His mother was a black Jewish woman. And as you can see, I tried to translate the title of this book. Now, this is called the number one on top here. It says The Invisible Government of the World. Now, that gives you the idea of where we're coming from. And then the name of the guy. Sorry?
There are 15 books before that.
Oh, yeah. Because The Invisible Government is, you know, has a lot of projects. It's a series of... Yeah. Then it says Ibn Saba, the name of the guy. And then it says he's the founder of the Freemasons in Islam. Now, they're going backward because, you know, the Freemasons were way after Ibn Saba. But anyway, or the son of the black woman, Ibn al-Sawda. And then it says here, the first who started crises and war in Islam. The first one who started all these feuds and antagonism in Islam. We lost it. I still have it here.
Conspiracy.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's their power. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah.
Oh, it's back here.
You have to pick a different topic.
Whenever I talk, something happens. Yeah, it's a conspiracy. Now, from the Shia side, there is the Sunni conspiracy against reinstating or sort of declaring Imam Ali as the successor of the Prophet. Now, if you guys know, there is a famous incident especially celebrated in the Shia literature about it's called the Ghadir Khum, which was an incident when the Prophet wanted to show his support to Imam Ali because he was a judge in Yemen and some people were complaining about his harsh decisions. So he simply said, you know, I support him. And the Shias took this as an evidence of him being the successor of the Prophet. As you can see in this picture, supposedly these are the Muslims coming back from Mecca to Medina with the Prophet, and they're responding to the Prophet declaring his support to Ali. And you have three people here standing on the side. Those three people, according to Shia literature, they are the first caliph, the second caliph, and the third one, who's supposed to be the source, who the books were depending on him and saying that they were whispering to each other once he dies, everything will be done. We will take over. You know, we will, for now, let's just say yes, but once he's dead, we'll, you know, Ali will not be the caliph. And this is actually what happened, but in a different story. I mean, it was not actually the same conspiracy, but later on, centuries later, people were writing that this is a conspiracy. They said this. They even say that one of them whispered to the other without saying who heard this whisper 700 years later. Now, does that mean we don't have conspiracies in our lives? Well, number one, married people know that there is always a conspiracy by the mother, right? Mothers-in-law. And I think I don't have documentation, so I said in the presentation that if we have married people in the audience, they would maybe testify to this. Yeah, they would know that, you know, mothers-in-law, daughters-in-law. I mean, we have a lot of cases of conspiracies against each other. Now, do we actually have conspiracies? The answer is simply yes, we do. I mean, we're not eliminating this idea at all 100%. I mean, what you see here simply is a declassified document from the CIA that talks about reinstating the Shah back in 1954 and overthrowing the socialist prime minister at that time who nationalized oil companies. So it was an operation. Now the CIA acknowledges. I mean, we knew that all the time, but now they acknowledge fully that, yes, we did that back in the 50s. They gave money. They, you know, they supported rallies against him. And things happen. So what governments call covert operations, we call them conspiracies. It's a bit of a stretch because people talk about conspiracy as the logic behind everything in history. But if we understand what falls under conspiracy in the minds of people, then this is one of the things that they talk about as a conspiracy. Now, there is also the Protocol of Sèvres in 1956, which is basically when the three countries, Israel, Britain, and France, they had a secret meeting and they agreed to have a scenario of attacking Egypt. And then the Brits and the French would come in as saviors of the Suez Canal, and that would help them in breaking the decision of nationalizing the Canal Suez. I mean, this is one example also of conspiracies, which is considered legitimate in the world of politics. I mean, in politics, you do whatever it is necessary for you to do to protect your own national interests. And at that time, it was the national interest of France, Britain, and the national interest of the U.S. to overthrow this obnoxious prime minister. Now, why do people resort to this interpretation of events or interpretation of history or religion or politics? One American historian gave us one reason, which you can see. The first one is the inability to channel political interests into representative groups. And that also could apply to minority groups in Islam. You can see that, for instance, the Shias, when they were oppressed under the Umayyad state, they resorted to this conspiracy theory of the majority because they could not have their voice heard. They could not channel their political interests. They were not represented in the political system at that time. So they resorted to this. And this applies also to other minorities in the state at that time. Now, in the third world, or especially in the Middle East, we don't have training in schools and in society on critical thinking. As we heard of the stories before, the story from Tunisia, and it applies to all the Arab countries, you listen in school, and you memorize, and you write down what the teacher tells you. And the exam, you are excellent, you get an A. If you write exactly what he told you in the classroom. If you deviate in any way, then you will lose points, and at the same time, you will be rejected by society. The other thing here is lack or distortion of information. Now, we don't have a documentation in the Arab world, let's say, of our political history. And even if we have, it's not open to public. You cannot go to Egypt, for instance, and ask for the documents of the 1967 war or 1956, although it's been 60 years. You simply cannot do that. Even if you're a scholar, even if you, I mean, they will question you for a long time, and then most likely you will be denied access. It's not just Egypt, most of the Arab countries. As we said also, conspiracy theory existed in interpretations of several religious and historic events. Like we just talked about the Sunni Shia, we also talked about the we also have, for instance, the protocol of the protocols that are attributed to the Zionist wise people who had a meeting supposedly in early in the 20th century. And we all know that it's fabricated. Everyone knows it's fabricated, but it's still one of the most widely sold books in the Arab world because it also subscribes to the idea that most of the problems that we have in the around the world right now is made by Jews, by Zionists. And they even say that the Arab Spring itself was orchestrated by those people. How? I don't know. I mean, how the CIA recruited al-Bouazizi to burn himself, that's still something to be discovered. There is also the convenience of having one model in your mind. When you're faced with complicated historic or political or religious topics, like for instance, the war between the companions of the Prophet, they're all pure Muslims, they're all believers. And yet, after the death of the Prophet, a few years later, they fought each other, they killed each other. So how do you fit this in your mind? Unless you have a model, one model that is simple, easy for you, whenever you're confronted with such events, you'll simply put this model and it solves everything. It's just like a magic software that solves everything for you. The other thing is, nowadays, dictatorships in the Middle East especially find this issue of interpreting all events using this model of conspiracy theory. It's very convenient for them because, number one, you're diverting the public from the actual cause of the problem, which could be, you know, no democracy, bad policies, whether it's economic or social or political, and you're simply directing them to an exterior enemy, which always works. It always works. You're being threatened by people who want to change the way of your lives. You are threatened by people who are attacking your religion, your beliefs. So people always turn their back to the dictator of that country, and they accuse whether it's the West or the U.S. or Israel or the international invisible government of the world, whoever this party is, and they throw the blame on them, and the dictator is sitting there happy with the result. Okay, now we have characteristics of conspiracy theory explanation that we can talk about in just a few points. Like, number one, it's simplification of analysis. It's someone is trying to harm us, someone is trying to attack us, bad people are targeting us. This is the main point of a conspiracy theory. And then you always hear the term them or they. Okay, it's a conspiracy by them. And who is them? God knows. I mean, they do that. They want to do that. And then we continue with the unknown pronoun. Lack of verified evidence. When we talk about conspiracy theory, we don't actually, as we said before, it's a belief more than it is something that is factual, something that can be proved. And the third point is the poor understanding of historic, social, economic, and political factors that contribute to certain events in a complicated way. Now, when you talk about the revolution in 1917 in Russia, when you talk about the Arab Spring, when you talk about complicated events in the world, you cannot simply just, if you don't have understanding of the social, the economic, the historic factors that actually helped create this event or this historic movement, then you simply resort to it's a conspiracy by them. And the last point is the world is divided into good and bad. And the bad people are always conspiring. And the bad people are always strong, by the way. They're strong and they're always conspiring against the good people. Now, let's go briefly to the point that we talked about in the beginning of the of our talk. Why is it more damaging to the Muslim communities? Why is the conspiracy theory? We have it here in the U.S., by the way. And about 15 to 20% of people who were asked about the 9/11 events in the U.S. still think that it is an inside job. And for a percentage like this in the U.S., that's a lot. But if you go to the Middle East, like in a country like Lebanon, for instance, the percentage was 65. In Egypt, it was almost 80%.
Because we're smarter.
Yeah, because you guys are smarter. Okay, why is it more damaging? Number one, it helps cover the religious, social, and political problems that we have in the Middle East, which we don't actually discuss openly and frankly through whether research centers or in the media. We don't really discuss our problems that openly the way we do it here in the West. And once you resort to conspiracy theory, I mean, you limit the discussion of the actual problems that are causing these issues in your country, and you're simply closing the door by saying it's a conspiracy by others, so we don't need to discuss any problems that we have. Number two is lack of free flow of information, which will deepen that conviction of the conspiracy theory. As I just said, I mean, here in the U.S., you have the FOIA, for instance. Right, you can go to the CIA archives, the FBI archives. You can go to the Library of Congress. I mean, the flow of information in the U.S. is way more open and transparent than that we have it back there in the Middle East. Actually, the sad fact is that most of what I know about the history of the Middle East comes from reading British books, British and French books, because they were colonizing us, thank God, at some point. So we know the history. It helps to further deepen the existing feeling of defeat. Now, we already have a feeling of defeat, whether it's militarily or scientifically or historically. On all levels, there is a hidden feeling of defeat in the Arab world or the Muslim world. We're behind. We're not as progressing as the other world, other countries are. So it helps also deepen that feeling that you are defeated. It enhances paranoia to the point of questioning science. Now, if you go online and see how many people are questioning the evolution or the Big Bang theory and considering them as also part of the conspiracy theory or simply just hoax, you'll be shocked. Now, the deep feeling in all the people who believe or societies that believe in conspiracy theory is simply we are helpless. The good guys and the bad guys, and someone is manipulating the world. Someone is with extremely super, you know, undefeated powers, will be able to conspire on us all the time, although we know what he's doing, but we are helpless. We cannot do anything about that. Now, examples of the conspiracy theory in the Arab world. For instance, the invasion of Kuwait in 1990. It says that the popular theory now is that the U.S. gave a green light through this meeting between Saddam and the American ambassador at that time. No one actually have the time to go and read the minutes of the meeting, which suggests nothing of that at all. There was no green light whatsoever. But if you go and ask Arabs, I would say something like 8 out of 10 would say to you, it is an American conspiracy against us. And Later on, as you guys know, in 1991, Saddam used the Islamic card and he declared jihad, and he was trying to use Islam against the U.S. So again, we're using religion with conspiracy theory. 9/11, we just talked about this. And as I said, about 65 to 80% think it's an inside job. Some people here in the U.S. also think it's an inside job. No evidence whatsoever has been provided at all that it was an inside job, that there were explosions put or bombs were put by the U.S. government in the towers, which is totally not true. I mean, and if it's an inside job, you'll have at least how many, 1,000 people to know about it? Because if the government is plotting, how many people do you have to tell in order for them to execute that? And the other thing is, the other interpretation, which is sort of a mild conspiracy theory, it says, no, the government did not do it, but it allowed the terrorists to do it in order to have a cause for its war on terror, which is, again, cannot be verified at all. Now, war on Islam. This is one of the very popular conspiracy theories. And as you can see, this is one of the flyers that you can see online by people saying or claiming that ISIS is completely manufactured, built, funded by, as you can see, ISIS did not come out of nowhere. It was seeded, cultivated, and fertilized by the West. GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and Israel. You see the interesting, intriguing combination of all these countries, which basically, I mean, this idea basically blocks any attempt to do any kind of reform, the one that Wissam talked about. Because once you say that ISIS is a Western-made manufactured, then we don't need to go back and talk about the literature that they depend on. We don't need to go back and look at what Ibn Taymiyyah said, what the fatwas that actually they depend on in their jihad, the fiqh al-raqiq, fiqh al-jihad, and all of that. We're not going to question anything. It's a Western plot against us. That's it. Case closed. Okay? Now, how do we deal with them? How do we counter the argument of conspiracy theory? Number one, we should acknowledge that we do have conspiracies in our world. I mean, it happens. Whether you call it a covert operation of the CIA or call it whatever you want to call it, but unless you have an evidence of that, let's not jump to conclusions. So when we tackle this topic, we should not eliminate this factor at all, but we should acknowledge it, but acknowledge it based on facts. Number one, the spread of facts. I mean, once you talk about theories and conspiracy theories, once you face these theories with facts, like the 9/11, for instance, I read a couple of books written by reporters plus engineers who actually explained all the details of how the towers fell and why, and responded to all these questions. Once you put the facts online, this will help a lot in the argument. Again, we said it's a faith; it's not a logical thing, but it helps to go to a certain distance and countering the conspiracy theory argument. And the use of social media actually is very powerful. Translation of facts and books and articles that talk about the factual basis of arguing against the conspiracy theory will help a lot in countering this. And something that we here don't have power on, it's, inshallah, it will happen in the future, which is to encourage critical thinking in schools, universities in the Middle East, which will help people to question what they read and question the conventional beliefs, whether it's religious, political, social, or whatever they are. Now, I think I'm done with time. Okay? Come on. Thank you.
Okay.
Great. So I thought that was an interesting talk. It was interesting because it's contrasted. I think we were talking about personal stories and stuff earlier, that you needed emotions to engage people. But it's interesting, in this talk you're saying if you're too emotional or you have too many personal stories, people get these conspiracy theories. So sometimes information is a good thing. Yeah, it's interesting. So we'll move to the panel discussion now. So we'll have a panel discussion until 5. So it'll just take us a couple minutes to set up. Now, we've been graciously hosted here by Hunter College. So normally they're actually not open, like this section. As you can see, there's no one here because they're not open. So they especially have opened this section of the library for us today. And so for that reason, we'll need to leave promptly. So after we finish the panel discussion, there'll be a quick closing statement. Please, like, take your body and just move. If you move to the bridge section, which is open throughout the day, that would be best, and you can continue your conversations there. Okay, so just take us a few minutes.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.